We opened Fresh Air today with a 1927 Johnny Dodds recording called Come On and Stomp, Stomp, Stomp. We've been putting out the word that Fresh Air is interested in finding record collectors who'd like to share some of the gems from their collections with our listeners. Every Monday at 4:30 throughout the summer, we'll meet a guest record collector and listen to some of the rare or unusual recordings from their collection. Jim Weaver of Delaware will be our guest record collector today at 4:30. At 4 o'clock, we continue the Radio Experience Special Series, another Fresh Air Summer series. Today's Radio Experience is on contemporary radio humor. Judy Stein reviews museum and gallery shows at 3:40, and at 3:30 we'll hear the last installment of Dan Lusk's series Off the Wall, reviews of the Small Literary Press. The American Library Association is currently holding its annual national convention in Philadelphia. There are approximately 3 to 5 reports a day from librarians around the country of attempts to ban specific books. Pressure groups who want to ban books say their tax dollars should not be used to disseminate offensive material. Others argue that book banning and censorship violate principles of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. At 3 o'clock today, we'll hear a documentary called The Public Library in America, An Experiment in Democratic Control. This is the 5th edition of our Bill of Rights series. With me now on Fresh Air are Jimmy Slide and Isaiah Lon Chaney, two tap dancers who've been performing for several decades, and since 1969 have been frequently performing together as part of a group called the Hoofers. The Hoofers have been touring with the Music Review 1,000 Years of Jazz. They've performed in Philadelphia yesterday as part of the Century 4 Jazz Concert by the Art Museum Steps, organized by the group Train Stop. Jimmy Slide started dancing in the late 1940s. He has danced with such jazz musicians as Teddy Edwards, Howard McGee, Sonny Criss, Jackie Byard, and the Cy Oliver Band. He also lived in Europe for about 5 years. Lon Chaney, who's known as the Dancing Devil, is an ex-prize fighter who's been dancing since the early 1950s. Before we speak with them about their dancing careers, let's listen to a selection from an album that Jimmy Slide recorded with Michael Silva. Michael Silver is a drummer, and also featured on this album is Major Holly on bass and Milt Buckner at the piano. And this is a sample from this French album, and we'll hear Tangerine.
Dancer, record, man.
Dancer Jimmy Slide, along with drummer Michael Silva, from an album on the Black and Blue record label, recorded and distributed in France. And Jimmy Slide and Lon Chaney are my guests, both members of the group The Hoofers, and want to welcome you. I enjoyed your performance yesterday. I wish it hadn't been interfered with by the rain.
You can't do anything about
that.
Nice being here yesterday and today also.
Yeah.
Do dancers have to have a trademark? Do you need a trademark that you're identified with and that the audience remembers you by? Jimmy Slide, yours is sliding.
Well,
it's one of them. It's one of them.
It's better, I think, to have. I mean, that shows that you have developed something on your own. And it's always best to be able to be trying to better yourself, you know. So it's better to have a trademark. You've tried harder to live up to it, you know. Myself, Slides.
How did you develop yours?
Well, I was taught by a very wonderful gentleman. I had seen, you know, in my day, I don't want to date myself, but there were quite a few theaters around. In fact, you had the Earl Theater here, I'm thinking of it at that time. The Apollo and some other great theaters, the Regal, and, you know, the Howard in Washington. And there were many acts, you know, dance acts, teams, trios, you know, single dances. And it was a good market for it then. So you had a chance to see many people. You know, you had heroes, just like they do now on television and things, and knew some wonderful dancers. And Raymond Winfield was with Tip, Tap, and Toe at that time, and
yeah.
I saw him, and I just wanted to slide, and I had a good teacher, Eddie Ford, schoolboy.
Lon Chaney, what's your trademark, and how did you develop it?
Yeah, well, my trademark, I learned how to dance. I was lucky. I walked into tap dancing. I was 28 years old before I ever thought about tap dancing. And I learned how to dance. I was walking the street one night, just lonely with no place to go, and happened to go in and see some jazz. And I saw somebody dance that fascinated me. A guy named was Baby Lones. And I was so fascinated by this man until I saw two of his shows. And when I come out the club that morning, I made up my mind that night that I would be a dancer. And with my rhythm, I used to be a drummer before that. I played a little drum, so I got to thinking about how I could move the rhythm from my hand down to my feet. And I asked a few people how would I come about being this dancer, and they advised me to go find the man that I saw, because he was the best. They said the man you saw was the very best. They advised me to find him and become his friend, and that was a good way to start. And that's exactly what I did. I went out and found the guy and started hanging up on him and going places where he danced.
Did Baby Lawrence give you any kind of rap about how if you want to become a dancer, then you have to be prepared to do this or be prepared to have such a kind of life or anything like that?
Yes, he told me to be a dancer that you really one thing you have to do. You have to practice while you're learning. You have to really practice. And the days that you didn't feel like practice, you have to practice anyhow. It's not very easy to become a tap dancer if you don't put something into it. You have to put a lot of time into it and get the foundation of it. Learn from the start. And if you learn it from the start and come up with it, then you can become a dancer. Not off the top. You got to learn the time step, the fundamental parts of dancing.
Right.
And after I got the fundamental parts of dancing, he showed me a lot of things. And after all the guys saw that I was so willing to learn, you'll be surprised. Dancers will come from all over to show you if it ain't but one step, if they see that you are willing. And that's what happened to me after they found out that I could dance and heard people talking about how much I was progressing. Then a lot of other dancers start coming and looking for me, and I was glad of that, and I made looking for them, and we start trading ideas. And Lawrence always told me, too, that in order to be a great dancer, I had to have my own style of dancing. He would not let me dance the way he was dancing. So I said, well, what kind of style is that? He said, well, let's keep searching. Go in the hall and just keep practicing, and you'll wind up getting it the way you can relax with it, and that's your style. And I wind up with a dance they call the paddle and roll, which was about drumming. It's paradiddles that you play from the drum. I took it and carried it down to my feet and put a lot of time into it. That's how I became a dancer.
Jimmy Slide, was there much street dancing when you were starting?
Yes. I'm from, let me say it like this. Philadelphia is well known, like we spoke of, for quite a few boxers and quite a few dancers and entertainers, because there was a market for it at the time. Boston was the same way. Boston was a real mecca for music, fighters, and performers, because there were a lot of clubs, there were a lot of theaters, there was a lot of show business around. So there was work. And that's the bottom line. You know, you work at something to be able to profit by it and become great at it, you know. And there were many great dancers around when I came along, which I'm saying I'm fortunate, because Bill Bailey, a lot of great dancers from here, Jerry Taps is from here. There were just a lot of great dancers around, and dancing was in the air. Everybody loved dancing. Albeit Shirley Temple was wonderful, and that was maybe a little bit, but it had merit to it, because a great dancer was teaching her, Bill Bojangles Robinson. So, yeah, I mean, you can never take it lightly, because she was tap dancing.
Yes.
You know, whatever Hollywood did with it, that's another story. It was real, really dancing, and people loved it. And they still do.
Yes.
Because it's exercise. This is what I'm trying to get to. Dancing is something you can enjoy doing.
All the time.
Lon Chaney, now you were a prize fighter before starting to dance.
Yes.
I would think that the demands on a body of a prize fighter are extremely different than one of a tap dancer. You think of a prize fighter as having to withstand blows and deliver them, and a tap dancer as having to, well, also be light on their feet, but just a lot more willowy and delicate and rhythmic, a different kind of rhythm from
boxing.
From boxing, yeah. You think of a really sturdy body for boxing and a really lithe, flexible body for dancing. I think that's it.
Yes, but you see, the body have to be good for boxing, but it also has to be good for dancing. See, dancing will keep the body active all the time. When you dance, I think you move every bone in your hand, including the one in your fingers. Every part of your body work when you tap dancing. Boxing, sometimes all the parts of your body don't work, but it gets you in tip-top condition. Dancing and jogging and boxing is very close together. And I found out that's why I'm become a dancer, because I'm hanging up on the physical part of it. Like Jimmy say again, the physical condition that tap dancing keep you in remind me of my boxing days, and I feel good like I felt when I was boxing. So that's why I keep dancing.
That is important. Feeling good.
Feel good.
A lot of people take dancing, like you say, just to carry on with what Chaney said. Many people take dancing not to become professional, but for the exercise involved. Just like you see the, what is his name, David Richard Simmons or something.
Oh, yeah, right. Yes.
Well, I mean, it's still exercise.
It's exercise.
And people would like to be able to move. You know, we've gotten to be a lazy race of people, I think. You know, I don't want to preach about it, but dancing is just a form of enjoyable exercise.
Yes, nice exercise.
And, you know, now there's a market for it, so it's enjoyable exercise. With significance, you can get a job on Broadway or off-Broadway, because dancers are very much alive now.
Very much alive. Yeah. Very much alive.
Jimmy Slade, where did you start performing once you started to perform? Was it at music clubs or?
It were in nightclubs. Clubs? Mm-hmm. Nightclubs, they were, because that was what was prevalent in those days. This was just after the war and things like that. And there were many nightclubs that had shows with four or five acts, you know, a band and a singer, the dancers or a team, a comedian and a novelty act or whatever. And it was just a nice way of living. But that was my beginning, you know, a lot of clubs.
The generation of musicians that you grew up with and came of age with were the musicians who started playing bop, which was a departure from the music of the past.
Yes.
Did that make your dancing style different from the generation of dancers who preceded you?
It had a big influence on me, because I was living, like you say, I was living at the time with like Jackie Byard and Miles and, you know, Bird and Dizzy and Gigi Grice and a lot of other people were in the air. Everything was in the air. And the same with dancing. Like we speaking of Baby Lawrence, there was Teddy Hale, Bunny Briggs. These are wonderful. They contributed something to dance. They weren't just, you know, dancers per se, you know, school dancers, you know, the shuffles and the hops. They were experimenting in different sounds, just like the musicians were. They were trying to find a new means of going along with the music.
Yes.
And it was always challenging, you know, to me. In fact, it still is.
Well, you were basically dancing to really different kinds of rhythms than your dance predecessors did.
In a sense, but the main thing which always impressed me was the swing. I never got beyond the swing. If it swung, that made sense to me. I'm what you call, I like swinging dancing. I like anything that swings, you know. That was the era preceding bop. But it was a carryover into it because, you know, they swung playing bop too, like they do. But it's still all parts of jazz, and like I say, it was growing when there was a market for it, like places to be seen and theaters and where they had the big bands and 8 or 9 piece shows, you know. And I'm just sorry it's not around because I think a lot of young people are missing something, even though they have the concerts, the rock concerts. It's not the same as going to the theater and the curtain opening and the big band is up on the stage and different wonderful people came out, you know.
And the dancer got to be super.
Yeah. And there always were dancers present. You didn't have a show without dancers.
Yeah.
Lon Chaney, how did you get your name?
Well, my name is Chaney. And from my boxing time, I had a silly looking look when I get hit. People don't like to get hit when they're boxing. And I really, Nipsey Russell, which is a good comedian. You've heard of him.
Great.
He gave me my first chance to be, you know, do my professional debut. And he gave me a book. He took pictures and different things and set up me a lobby like I supposed to have, like all entertainers. It was worth about $500 back in that time. He had liked my dancing so well. He saw me dance. See, he knew me when I was not a dancer. And he saw me about a year and a half later, and I was a dancer. And he was amazed. I didn't start out in the clubs. I started dancing in the street just for fun. And after I learned how to dance in the street, I used to go around and look for professional dancers. And you'd be surprised. A lot of professional dancers do perform in the street, do dance in the street. And then especially when they meet another dancer, they always have something to show different from what he showed you the last time or what he did the last night. So Nipsey Russell used to come by a place where I was working, which I was a manager of a supermarket. He used to come by there in the morning time and bring professional people by, like after he closed the Baby Grand. And they would start talking about who's the best dancers. And he would always bring people by and say, this man, yeah, you know, has got a style of dancing that I hadn't seen before. Nipsey's a pretty good dancer before itself. And he asked me to come up and make this book and things like that so I would have something to work off. He thought that I could dance good enough to be a professional dancer. So he invited me up to the Baby Grand, and I went up to the Baby Grand, and he presented me this book after I did the show for him that night. And he said, this book here, he had written up on top of the book. My name was Chaney, and he wrote on top of that, Lon Chaney, the Dancing Devil, the King of the Paddle and Roll. See, the Paddle and Roll was kind of, that's more modern. It's like Jimmy say again, jazz tap dancing been around a long time, but it comes down, it all boils down, it's like old music come into bebop. We are younger people, and we see the older way. Probably we learn how to dance the older way people learn, but as we keep dancing, we find out how to bring it in with the music of in the air that him and I came along, which is in bebop. We find out to take it and transpose it from the older style, like Ralph Brown and them, George Hillman and them got an older style of dancing, but it's jazz. But Jimmy and I and different people our age brought it in with Charlie Parker and Baby Lawrence was a firm believer in Charlie Parker. He was dancing way back in the olden days, but he was always modern. And I think him and Teddy Hill and people like that always trying to modernize, Raymond Winfield and them, they always trying to modernize. They would take it and turn it around from the way the old timers do and bring it the way they do it, see? So that really, tap dancing changed, just like Jimmy say, just like music does. You got people that studies it and change the beat. And then another 10 years, maybe a kid come along and he would call my dance something else and he'd be doing a little bit different from what I'm doing it too, but it'll be the same pattern.
So are there different steps that you do?
There'll be different steps that you put in there to make the dance different. Yes, we believe in the change is tough. See, you got to be changed. The type of dance we do, jazz tap dancing, is just like music, notes and music. When you play a record, you don't play the record in the same key. You have to change key. So what we do, we change the steps and change breaks. and we don't dance every 4 or 8. We might dance every 2. Or every, you know, started at 2 and 4 and 8 and 6 and up like that. That's the way I see.
If you're just joining us, I just want to reintroduce you for our listeners just tuning in. I'm speaking with Lon Chaney, who was just speaking, and Jimmy Slide, and they're both tap dancers, and they're both two members of the group The Hoofers, which has been together since 1969. They've done a lot of touring and have toured with the group 1,000 Years of Jazz. What were you going to say, Jimmy? I'm sorry.
No, it was just going along with the conversation because, you know, like you were asking before, do identify yourself about being identified? Well, when you come up with different steps, when you come up, just like music, not that you change the entire thing, but you can come up with a different way of approach, you know, a different approach to it. And it has more interest. You know, it creates interest. Somebody says, oh, I like that. Like I say, I'm still a student, you know. In Europe, they call me a professor, you know, Professor de Claquette, you know.
That's great.
Which sounds great.
Well, he was teaching the teachers.
In other words, I'm just a teacher, but I did confined to teaching the teachers.
Yes, he did.
And it's always good to be able to learn something, but I would always tell the students, I say, you call me a professor, but I'm still a student, because that's the way I feel about it. You know, I've never become that grand that I couldn't learn something.
No.
And that's really important in dance, because you can see somebody that's just started dancing, they may hit something
get
that you
something
see,
that you like,
something that goes that you can see goes to it, you know.
Yes.
So it's it's beautiful art.
Now him and I, be surprised. We can just share a lot of things together. I could be sometime before I go on stage, like in the corner, warming up over there, and something I might do over there in the corner, he will hear it, and he will tell me, say, "Well, yeah, that sounds good. Put this on tight, or maybe this would go on tight, or something like that." And he would show me something that to go with my dancing. He would show me something to go on to what he saw me did over there. Okay. And I would listen to him and listen at him, because, believe me, that's very important. That's another form of the education part of it. And I would do what he tell me or show me that would go with what I did over there. And the next thing I know, I would have me a 8-bar steps or 4-bar steps, and it would be good. So I take that and work it in. That's why it's good to be around great dancers. Him and I get around very good by being, you know, learning from each other.
Dancers had a rapport. Like I said, there was a mutual feeling. We were in the same art. And you could share it, because there's plenty to go around. You'll never learn all of it. But you can share with the other dancers. And that was primarily what happened, which I'm speaking about in the days when there was showbiz. Because you go from one city to another, one East Coast to the West Coast. There was West Coast style dancing, there was Midwest style, there was Eastern style, there was, and but it was still intermingled, because it was all tap dancing and jazz.
When you started to dance in 1949, it was the tail end of the American musical films. The period when there were lots of musicals was on the verge of ending. There's just about a few years before that went,
unfortunately,
was curtailed.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to make any movies?
Well, as I told you, I lived in California for a while. I had a very small part in A Star Is Born with Judy Garland, like that. If you blink your eye, it was gone, though. You know, one of those. But we worked for a long time.
It was
interesting, and it was a big film. And, you know, you got paid well. But as far as being noticeable in any films, not only in a film in Europe, there was a jazz film done, and I had a nice part in that. Most of my things have been done in Europe. Not much at home here, dear old America. They kind of left me by the wayside somewhere, but, you know, it'll work out.
What did you think of the Hollywood film sensibility? Did you and did the choreographers on the film have the same idea of what a good dance was?
Most times, probably not, because they were seeing with much better eyes than I had. They were seeing things that would be projected as images, which was an altogether different thing from my little knowledge of show business. You know what I mean? It's a much grander scale. But that's the difference between picture dancing and actual dancing, I think. Because picture dancing, I'm just telling you like a trade secret, the steps and the dances or the sound is not being made at that time. The movement is being made at that time, but it is you know, the dancing part is done at another time, in another place, to sync with the that is being done on the screen. And that's not the same as an actual live appearance.
So the sound is dubbed in and that...
All.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most of the time. I mean, there may be one or two films that it wasn't dubbed in, but I don't know of them. You know, the sound always had to be dubbed out because the films were perfection. When you're dealing in perfection, there's no room for a miss here or an error there. And so that was the grand greatness of it. But that's the difference between picture dancing and actual dancing.
Did you ever get to do any films?
Yes, we did one for the Natural History in New York. We did a film for there. We done in the Hawkeyes there.
And not Hollywood.
Yeah, not Hollywood.
You're speaking of the Hollywood, the real motion picture.
From what I see of dancing and from my experience since I come into it, I met all the great dancers. And I'm not just as a dancer. I was fortunate enough to have these men sometimes together for socializing and things like that. And let's talk about the time of dancing and how many people they danced with or what happened back in that era. I'm pretty well equipped with it because I know all the dances. In fact, I was the one that brought the jazz tap dances together after I learned how to dance. I thought that if we could get together, because Jimmy got an open mind like myself. In previous time, dancers didn't have an open mind. They was far apart from each other, like in some way. They didn't see fit to team up and be buddies like me and him and swap ideas like him and I and a few other great dancers. And from my recollection, what they tell me about Hollywood and, you know, the movie, they didn't make the movie because they really was the type of dancers that believe like him and I believe, like if you go shoot me, let me go ahead and do the dance and you take it as I go. And just like you start mixing acting with it and talking and making a story out of it like that, it's really not jazz tap dancing, that's picture dancing, see? And our thing is jazz tap dancing, like Duke and Count played on the piano, jazz. We produce the song. We will make sure that a blind man can come there and listen at our show and knowing that they heard the human machine in operation. And I don't think Hollywood was just ready for that type of dancing. So therefore, a lot of dancers, especially black dancers, didn't make Hollywood.
You know how musicians distinguish between jazz and pop?
Yeah.
I guess there's that same distinction for dancers.
In some way, they were looking for picture dance. They were looking for story.
There is a distinction.
There's a distinction. Yeah.
Because in the picture dancing, like we say, you have to be capable of being directed.
Right, here's
you know
the stance,
I mean?
You do it.
Everything comes from you.
I mean, you are there to project for the people, the audiences. That's the difference than for mass audiences, which motion pictures were, you know. And you have to be able to be directed, which, like I say, it's an industry. And you don't change the industry. Either you fit into it. And I think the dancers just got a little bit of the lesser benefits from it, I think, you know.
To your eyes and ears, who were the best film tap dancers?
The best film tap dancers? Well, of course, Bill Robinson, like I say, because his sound was immaculate. That is so clean, so perfect, that there's nothing they had to do with that. No doctoring, no buttons, no nothing. Him. He was wonderful because he did appear on the screen. The Nicholas Brothers were fantastic.
Yes.
Donald O'Connell, I like very much. Of course, Fred Astaire is, you know, you can't say too much about Fred, but Fred went into the ballroom, which was more lucrative than tap. That doesn't mean he didn't tap. He did some tap.
Yeah, he's a little
Gene
tap.
Kelly, I never saw tap much. I've often heard people say, I'm not knocking you, Gene.
Yeah.
I've often heard people say I want, but he was more of a jazz dancer to me. Jazz, modern jazz, in that there.
Ballet type
not
of tap.
Much, yeah, which is, well, not much tap. I never saw him do much tap. His brother, Fred Kelly, is a great
Fred
tap
was
dancer.
Better dancing than him. That's my yeah.
I know, you look
confused
because you don't.
Yeah.
I know. A lot of people haven't, but he's a wonderful tap dancer.
And the reason
Gene's
why
heard of him.
Yeah.
But Gene's a great dancer. I take nothing from him. Another dancer that I like very much was Ray Malone.
Ray Malone.
He was really a fantastic
beautiful dancer out of Texas.
And he worked quite a few movies and things. I mean, I'm naming people because you asked that you might not hear about, but the Condos brothers,
Yeah.
Nick and Steve Condos. Tremendous. They did quite a bit of work in the motion pictures. And they were fantastic dancers.
But they also, I don't think, went and reached their potion in the motion picture, because there was jazz tap dancers. And like I say, if they couldn't fix it the way they could cut it and do what they want to do with it, sometimes they just didn't be bothered with it to pick them big pictures and things like that there.
Well, let me insert this. I don't think jazz was ever big in Hollywood. No, I mean, you know, so we just know where our conversation is. There's no... Jazz was never... You know, they made a few pictures, Glenn Miller's Life or whatever, this or that. But as far as jazz, they never exploited jazz that much. Not for motion pictures. I don't think that they thought it was salable. You know.
Sure, and there were like nightclub sequences with big bands, but once bop was the jazz music, there was, I think, virtually nothing.
Nothing. I mean, you know, which is, you know, we say if we associate ourselves with an era and things like that, you take the demise as well as the kudos. And there weren't many kudos for jazz, you know.
Yeah.
But it's still alive. Like they say, we live it.
I think it was LaVon Robinson who said this, and I hope I'm not misquoting him, so my apologies in advance in case I get this wrong. But I think he said that once the Nicholas Brothers started performing with their more acrobatic style, that it made it difficult for dancers who weren't acrobatic, because audiences were prepared to see that.
No, I don't agree with that. I don't. I think that made it more noticeable, because if people didn't quite understand what your feet were doing, there was still something visual that which went with the motion pictures. You know, you don't get a chance to slide down a 50-foot sort of banister, you know, this two people and meet at the end and come up in a, you know, go down and split. And you don't find many places to equip to handle those kind of things, or a wall that you can run up and do a backflip over, you know. But still, it showed you what can be done, and they were capable, and they really did it.
And they're original, too. See, the Nicholas Brothers are original dancers. Yeah, they started what they did. They found it, and they was good. But that's not the problem. The problem is that the big media did not take jazz tap dancing. The problem is that. Now, the young people, Jimmy and I dance all over the world. We've been into about 35 countries. In the United States, we have young people here that have never really seen jazz tap dancing.
Tap dancing, period.
Jab tap dancing.
Even
they didn't see it,
jazz,
you see?
They haven't seen tap dancing.
The big media in Hollywood don't care, and they don't see it on the screen. That means that it don't be seen. Just like right now, a lot of people think tap dancing is dead because they don't see it as much as they should be seen it. But the young people right now in America, young and old, all the people know what it is. But you'll be surprised. We've been doing concert with 12,000. 14,000 people. We do concert right here in New York City, and we did it in the college this last past year, and sold out everywhere we went. The younger people come up to us and ask us, why hadn't we seen this dance? How long, who are you guys? Where you come from? This is what the young people come up all the
which
time.
Which is flattering.
You understand? Why hadn't we seen that? I said, well, the movie. They said, well, no, we've seen the movie, but this is different. And they are right. We can't tell them that it's the same in the movie, because it wasn't. And all we need to do now is not being bitter with Hollywood or nothing like that, but all we need to do now, I feel, is let's show it to the younger people more in America, and let's take the art and put it together and let everybody enjoy the art, you understand? Because people like what they see. If they see it and it's good, they like it. And they really like it. We've been dancing all over. And what we need to do now is don't
continue.
Don't push it under the rug like we once did. What we need to do now is keep it on the table and keep it so the young Americans can get a hold of it. People is paying a tremendous amount of money in Europe and everywhere else to learn this dance. And here we got it at the tip of our finger, and our kids almost don't know what it is. So that's Jimmy and I's purpose, is to make sure Chuck Green, Jimmy and myself, we are dedicated to it. We gonna make sure.
And there are many others. There are many other
many
dancers.
Others. I just named
we're
a
not
few.
The only ones. You know, no. There are quite a
Baby
few
Lones,
dancers.
Like he's dead now, but
I'm talking about active now.
Now,
alive.
Yes.
There are quite a few, because Broadway has come on very strong in the last two or three years.
Right.
A lot of your good, great shows.
Yeah, been having dances. We've been seeing
quite a bit of tap dancing numbers, featuring tap numbers with good dancers. Gregory Hines.
Yeah.
He's doing wonderful, and the sophisticated ladies, he's tapping up a storm, as well as singing and doing things. And all along Broadway, a lot of the shows, that you see more and more And that's encouraging.
Do you think the younger dancers are going to have a different kind of rhythm or music that they're dancing with?
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yes.
But they will come. You would want them to carry on, then, yeah. You know, like we say, and develop into something.
Don't be like me. You know? Get my pattern and take it and do it the way they do it. Sure,
be like
they
you
will
to
have.
A point. Yeah. I understand what you've done because you've contributed.
Correct.
But carry it on, you know.
Carry
that's what we're really about.
We're looking like to pass it down and make sure that the younger people know. And we are going to make sure that it doesn't die out because we know that it ain't a lot of great dancers around. There's quite a few around now that we can really hold on to, but it ain't that great till everybody should be working at what they can do. There's a lot of people should be working at it every day. But we're going to make sure that it come back up onto the top of the heap. We've been having it in concert, which is a very good thing. And like Jimmy said, the Broadway play has been featuring it. Yeah. And that's very good. You understand? It's good for everybody. And once people get into it and find out the condition that it keeps you in and the heart that it gives you to stand up in the front of everybody, if it ain't dancing, you might be a politician later on or somebody making a speech. All that helps. Dancing helps you to stand up in the crowd of a people. And whatever you have to do, you can deliver it. Because if you get out there and you can't dance and you're not front of the people there, it ain't too late for you to start throwing eggs at you, so it was very good.
Lon Chaney and Jimmy Slide are my guests, if you're just joining us, and they've been dancing together off and on since 1969 in a group called the Hoofers, and Jimmy Slide's been dancing since the late 1940s, Lon Chaney since the early 1950s. You've done some work in Vegas, haven't you, Jimmy Slide?
Yeah, I worked there.
What's that like? Is that... Is the sensibility a lot different than either Hollywood or
New
York
jazz? First of all, it's such a combination of Hollywood and Monte Carlo and all the great places because the best, the biggest and the best of everything appears there. And they have it set up for it, Hollywood style. You know, the stages and the sets and the scenery and all like that. It's grandeur. I mean, it's the best you can see of anything. And they have their style of things. It's not my style of thing. I don't think they swing enough, but they have all of the glamour and the glitter. It's hard working there because it's many hours, late hours, and much heat. You know, and you have to schedule yourself there like anywhere else, or condition yourself, I should say. Because I was working with a very wonderful group. I'm going back quite a few years. It was called Billy Williams Review. And he was with Imogene Coker and what's her name? Sid Caesar. At that time, you know, Billy Williams had a great singing group. And he had a review with him, a girl trumpet player, Clora Bryant, who was fantastic. A singing group, dancer and like that. But we worked in the lounge. And you see everybody in the big room, which was the Riviera at that time, Harry Belafonte, you know, all the great kind of acts and things. But it's just, it's so competitive that you don't get a chance to see anybody else. They're all there, but you're working so hard, you don't see anybody until the night that you have off. And then you go all the places and
see everybody.
It's fantastic to be around because you're really in the best of show business. You see everything that's going on currently, you know.
Yep.
But they never lean towards tap too much. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
I've never heard of any great extravaganzas featuring any tap numbers or anything. Maybe unless Mitzi Gaynor or somebody like that or Shirley MacLaine did it in their review. But I think one of the problems there is I don't think you have the choreographers capable of giving really a swinging tap number. That's my estimation.
Right.
You know.
In order for them to do that, we play Vegas about a year and a half ago.
Last year we played the Aladdin.
And our group was one of the first group that come in there that they allowed, that had the freedom to bring it in, you know, bring jazz tap dancing in there. And we had a very good crowd. In fact, we were supposed to have another intern engagement there. I don't know when, but they was working on it. And Vegas, just like Jimmy said, I really had been a lot of fun in Vegas because the way we was doing it, it was the way that we do it every place else. They accept us there with it. I think our group was the first group that they accept in Vegas with the jazz tap dancing the way we brought it
because
in.
Because of the show in its entirety.
Because of the show our group was.
But let me say
this. Very successful.
At the same time when we were there, we were there for about 3 or 4 nights, and we had beautiful crowds and like that.
Yeah.
But on the one night we weren't there, they had the Grateful Dead. You want me to tell you how many people couldn't even get in? So that speaks for itself. The one night, you couldn't even, we lived in the place. We couldn't even get near where we lived. There were so many other people that came in just for the Grateful Dead.
Right.
So that leaves it there. That's Vegas.
You've danced, I'm sure, on some really good and really bad floors. The floor probably has a lot to do with how well your dance is going to be performed each night. What makes a good dance floor?
Sound, primarily. Wood.
Wood.
If it's wood, you'd be surprised that just that one little word, you don't run into it too often. Just wood.
Good solid wood.
Now you run
wood.
Into, you know, the other floors, you know, the backlight, you know, the composition floors, the this, that. But you don't run into really good wooden floors right now. Mm-hmm. Because if you do, it has to be in the theaters, and some of them got the ripples in them, you know, yeah. And the boards aren't down and like that. Yeah. But just good wood, oak. And
yes.
Then most stages and places aren't made of them now. They use, like I say, the plywood or, you know, a couple of sheets of that.
But you can run into some of the theaters that been around a long time, and they have the best floors.
That's
the
right.
One that was
the
older theaters that you used to dance in before they tried to sweep dancing under the rug, they are still the best floors.
Yep.
And a lot of people make a mistake sometimes. They put things on the floor to preserve it, paint, and whatever.
To make them look good for movies.
And,
I mean, there has to be a visual aspect there for all the places now. You know, in your studios and things, you don't have any wooden floors or anything.
Yeah.
Because you have dollies.
Right.
You can't have any creaking boards for television. You can't have, you know, the limitations and restrictions.
Right.
But wooden floors, hard to come by.
And again, that's where condition, having yourself in condition, because you never know what kind of floor you will run into.
Right.
And I say again, if you're not in condition, you cannot do the dance. If you're doing 4 course, you can't do but 2.
Well, how do you get around the bad floor? What do you do to compensate?
You got to work on it. You just got to work on it. You got to put more efforts. There's no way to getting around it. You got to double, triple the efforts that you would be putting if you had a good smooth floor like this tabletop. You got to put 3 times more effort into your dancing to bring it up when you run into a bad flow. You can't get wrong, and there's no shortcut for it. You got to work harder. So that's what I was saying again. If you're in condition, you still can conquer it. But if you're not in condition, you won't make it.
For me, you know, floor is very important.
Very
because
important.
I slide.
Yeah.
You know, I've run into a lot of them that, you know, it looks like the waves in this ocean, you know. Not quite that bad. That's exaggeration. But anything that's unlevel or uneven, you know, I can hit it and go flying. So I don't slide as much on some floors because you have to work around it. It can be dangerous, you know. You know, you fall a lot in sliding. What I do, you know, it's just like ice skating. I don't care how great you are or anything. You can always land on the derriere, you know. So
what do you do when you fall?
Get up.
Get up and dance.
Dancing.
I saw him fall off the stage, you know, one night, and we all got skated. And Jimmy crawled back up on the stage and danced harder than we danced before. He fell off the stage in the village gate.
Well, you know.
Fell off. It happens.
No one's perfect. But the idea is to get up, you know, you
keep
be
going.
As graceful as you can. But, you know, dancing, you make a little few mistakes here and there. It can cost you. But
yeah.
For the most part,
everybody falls,
stay in shape.
Sometime.
You know how when you're dancing, there'll be certain steps that you'll do where the whole audience will simultaneously break into applause. Mm-hmm. Are those moments usually the most difficult for you? Does the audience usually pick up on what you'd want them to pick up on, or do you find that the applause-getting moments aren't really the highlights of what you're doing?
Well, I think I feed off the audience. If the audience is good, and one thing I like, again, is big audience. The bigger the audience is, the more soup I can dance. And I feed off the audience. They're nice and friendly and clap. And I don't think it's one step that you look for the applause. I think when they applause, I think you look for more difficult steps to keep them applause. And I think the more they applause, the more they pushes me myself. That's what happened to me. It's got a great deal to do with the audience. You can stay in the rehearsal studio and rehearse all you want. It doesn't quite add up as if you're dancing in front of people. You must have the critics there. The people got to look at it. That's how you get it over people in front of an audience. That's the best way.
You want to add anything to that?
I feel that way also. But, I mean, I think when, for the most part, when you have audiences and they applaud, they don't necessarily applaud the difficult things you do. They might just applaud your approach to something. The simpler things, I find that the simple things that I do are more, you get more response than the more difficult things, you know, because I don't think the people realize the difficulty involved in some of the things that you do. But it's gratifying to know that they appreciate what they do appreciate. So that kind of levels it off for me. I don't look for applause, you know. At the end, you'd like to know that they enjoyed it or that it was worth something, you know. But in the midst of a dance, most of the time, I'm surprised if anybody applauds. In fact, I very seldom get any applause in the middle of anything. Because it's not there. I think it's in its entirety when you finish. But sometimes you get
in between.
Someone sees something that they enjoy, and that brings about another response from me. You know?
You've mentioned some of the difficulties in keeping jazz tap dance going at times when it isn't as saleable or as popular. What about musicians now? Are jazz musicians interested in performing with tap dances?
Yes. Falls back.
I think so.
Oh, yes. All of them I know. I mean, me and Jimmy got... I think we're more friendly now with jazz musicians than any time else in tap dancing. Because all good jazz musicians, they always had tap dances around them. And I noticed the younger one now, like we played over there yesterday, we had the younger men's over there. They was delighted that we was on the bill with them. And I think that the relationship between the type of dance we do and the jazz musician is very similar. So when we play any place, I meet people all the time. They say, let me know when you got something. I mean, good musician. And someone working, and say, look, I'll call you. See, musicians call me and get us a lot of works, too, because they like to dance with us. The day, I think, is very great between the jazz musician and the jazz dancer.
It's closer.
Good relationship.
It's gotten closer because they don't look at us as show business and them as music business. You know, they know that... you're not, per se, in show business anymore. We're part of the overall jazz program. Not they're playing for you because you're a dancer and you're the show.
Stop.
See, you get away from the show aspect of it, even though you are showing, but you're not distracting from the music that's being played. I think it's more
inspiring
coherence now.
Yes.
Well, there's also this image, and I think this is more from showbiz-type dancers, of it being old-fashioned, like in the 60s, what could be like more passé, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't know if that ever really applied to jazz tap dancers, since
prevalent.
You were in a separate thing anyway.
No, but it was prevalent at times because, you know, most of the times of the clubs that I worked in, there weren't jazz musicians. In the show business, you know, I played with, there was an accordion, there was a piano, and there was a violin.
Yes.
I mean, I've worked clubs, you know, clubs you worked with whatever band was there or whatever the house band was, so to speak. And I've worked with many different organizations, you know, groups, but that was set up for the show. But the jazz, when they played clubs, the jazz, they were presented and they were the feature. But you didn't have many dancers appearing with the jazz, other than Baby Lawrence or the greats like Teddy Hill or something, and they were trying to inaugurate something in that era. But now there's more, like I say, there's more coherence there because we are in the same, and we're under the same title, jazz. We're concerned with jazz music. We relate to it. We dance to it. We sleep it, live it. And
they do the same thing. And, we inspire
so we're accepted in that sense, you know. We're not putting somebody out of work. We might, in fact, possible for
somebody
to get another job, you know.
Yes.
Like on the festivals, they put a dancer or two dancers or something with different groups. It makes a bigger market for it, and it's interesting.
Yes.
You know, just like different groups can be interested, different dancers with them.
Jazz tap dancing belongs with jazz band anyway. I see it as a jazz. I see it belongs in the front of a jazz band. The only way I see that you'll ever get the full result of good jazz tap dancing is in the front of a jazz band. It's like Jimmy say, he hit the nail right on the head. A lot of people will take it and put it with different things. It'll look good and it'll hold up, but it won't be outstanding as far as I see it as when you put it in the front of a good jazz band. That's really where you see jazz on jazz.
Jazz on jazz.
That's the way I see it. And it catch like that. Jazz band, that's where it belongs, in the front of a good jazz band.
Well, I've really enjoyed speaking with you both.
And hey, pleasure.
I wish you the best with your dancing and with your group, the Hoofers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Jimmy Slide and Lon Chaney, two of the members of the group, the Hoofers. They also perform independently, and they've toured around the country and around Europe as well.
Yeah.
And we're performing yesterday as far as part of the John Coltrane tribute, A Century Four and Train Stop production that was by the Art Museum Steps. And let me play another selection from an album that Jimmy Slide recorded in France with a drummer named Michael Silva. We heard a selection from this a little earlier. This is on the Black and Blue label, which is their French label. We'll hear Watch What Happens.
Yeah.
That was Watch What Happens, and we heard Jimmy Slide tap dancing along with Michael Silva on drums. They used to have a performance thing together called Taps and Traps, and the selection we heard is from an album on the French label, Black and Blue. The pianist was the late Milt Buckner, and that was Michael Silva on drums. And this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia, and we have another tap performance for you. This is from the film You Were Never Lovelier, which starred Fred Astaire and Rita Hayworth. And in the scene, we're going to hear Fred Astaire as tapping along with the orchestra led by Xavier Cugat. Fred Astaire with Xavier Cugat from the film You Were Never Lovelier. It's a minute to three, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. I want to remind you that at 4:30, we'll be joined by a guest record collector, and this is part of our regular Monday series. Our guest today will be Jim Weaver, and we're looking for guest collectors who have collections that have unusual or rare recordings in them, and that's coming up at 4:30 today. At 4 o'clock, we continue the Radio Experience special series, and the subject today will be contemporary radio humor. The American Library Association is having its annual convention in Philadelphia. One of the big issues facing libraries now is censorship. There are special interest groups around the country who are trying to ban books that they find disagreeable. They say that taxpayers' dollars shouldn't be used to support books that they don't like, and other groups say this is a violation of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Coming up, we're going to continue our 9-part Bill of Rights series, and the subject today is libraries and pressure groups.
If we're going to have a true democracy in this country, we need to see that the First Amendment applies to everybody, not just the liberals.
The Bill of Rights Radio Education Project presents Public Libraries and the First Amendment.
I think I could probably say that the Founding Fathers would turn over in their graves if they knew some of the things that was being defended under what is called the First Amendment.
Sponsored by the Pacifica Foundation and the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation.
It scarcely matters what they find offensive in my book or any book, because this is a country where the law permits the free circulation of all ideas, no matter how offensive. No book need defend itself in this country. That's the law.
With major funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Like many Southern American communities, Washington County, Virginia has schoolhouses, churches, and country music. The small town of Abingdon is the county seat. Abingdon's people are proud of their town's history and culture, and especially proud of their modern public library over on Oak Hill Street. But right after the 1980 presidential election, the library became a center of controversy.
The fact that a book is housed in the library gives it a prestige. When I was a child, I had that type of confidence in the library. I did not know that they had, in effect, turned our library into an adult bookstore. To my sad amazement, that is basically what we've gotten here. Instead of buying good literature, we've had those that chose to buy pornography.
Just about everybody in the county knows Reverend Tom Williams, pastor of Emmanuel Baptist Church. In 1974, he pressured the local school board to ban a series of textbooks that he found objectionable. He was also the moving force behind the board's decision to teach creation science in the county schools. Reverend Williams decided to take on the public library when three local businessmen were charged with selling obscene literature to minors. Their attorney argued that magazines like Dude and Hustler are no more obscene than some books on the open shelves of the public library. Bestsellers like Harold Robbins' Lonely Lady and Sidney Sheldon's Bloodline. After speed reading the books, the Reverend took to his pulpit, shocking his congregation with selected excerpts.
They are graphic, explicit sexual descriptions of perverted sex scenes, even down to the minutest detail of even the movement of the tongue and oral sex, which to me is unconscionable. When you come and ask the people of a county to provide that type of pornography through the use of tax dollars.
The first time I met him, he came into the library and he wanted a list of all the books by Sidney Sheldon and all the books by Harold Robbins.
23-year-old Kathy Russell is the director of the Washington County Library.
We then wanted this list of names because if they wrote with a pornographic mind, then everything they wrote would be pornography, and he wanted that list, so I gave him that, and then he asked me for a list of the names of the people who had checked out the books, and I told him that I couldn't give him a list of the names.
Suspecting the Reverend wanted to prove that children were reading the books, Kathy Russell consulted with the American Library Association in Chicago. She spoke to the director of the Office on Intellectual Freedom, Judith Krug.
When the librarian in Abington called, I said, you don't have to worry about that request because your records are specifically exempted from the Virginia State Open Records Law by statute.
You have a right to express your ideas and to receive ideas anonymously, the right to read without having other people know what you're reading.
John Shattuck is the legislative director for the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington, D.C.
If I go to a library and take out a book that is unpopular in my community, I should have a right to read that without anybody else knowing about it.
Civil libertarians say that privacy is protected by the constitutional guarantee of free expression. 9 states, including Virginia, have laws that specifically protect the privacy of library patrons. But state laws and constitutional rights did not sway Reverend Williams. He and a group of his followers began pressuring the library to remove the books. He threatened to sue Kathy Russell for distributing obscene literature to minors until he discovered another state law that protects librarians. Others in the county resented the pressure exerted on their library. They protested as loudly as the Reverend and his followers. The local library board, a group of appointed citizens, finally voted to support the young librarian's refusal to remove the books.
I think that Ms. Russell, the library board, and everyone else involved in this controversy must come to the conclusion that this library and what we do in Washington County should not be dictated to us by a group of liberals in Chicago. Whatever they call themselves, whether they call them